I had met Sam just 2 years ago on a road trip to the Grand Canyon with our friends, and we had clicked. Since then, we had done over 9 such road trips, from Yellowstone to Europe and India. But then we decided to do the Australian outback. We were young and high on adventure. But all that changed when our car broke down. Hours passed before we saw anyone. The sun was sinking into the dust, and I was getting worried. I had heard that it could be days before you would see anyone in the Australian outback because the place was so deserted. But that is when a truck finally pulled up. The driver, Grant, was about 50, grizzled and lean, with sharp eyes that didn't waste a second to check out my body. He offered to help, his voice gravelly, his smile a little too wide. Sam was relieved, but my sixth sense felt that something was wrong.
Maybe we should wait for someone else, Sam. He just... I don't know.
Sam laughed it off. I tried to let it go. But the whole time we drove with Grant, my eyes kept drifting to his hands on the wheel, his fingers tapping out an odd rhythm. He'd glance in the mirror and check me out. His questions were strange, too. Personal, probing, as if he were peeling us apart one layer at a time. We stopped at a small shack for gas from where he got us water. He must have slipped something into it, because even though I did not drink the water, Sam did. Soon after, his eyes started to droop, and his words started to slur. Back on the road, Sam's head lulled. His hands slipped from mine, and my pulse spiked. That's when Grant's face changed. He didn't bother with smiles anymore, just yanked the van off the road, saying that there was a puncture. But the next moment, he opened my side of the door and slammed a wrench on my head. He then pulled out a set of cable ties, tied our hands, our feet, even gagged us. He dragged us into the back of the van, and I realized how well prepared he was. This wasn't the first time. Night fell as he drove us deeper into the desert, farther from the highway, from any hope of rescue. I lost track of time, sinking in and out of a fog of terror. When the van finally stopped, Grant opened the back doors. He grabbed Sam first, dragging him out, and I watched, helpless, as he tied him to a post in the sand. He turned back to me, his voice low.
Don't even think about running, beautiful. Just sit tight on those lovely thighs of yours.
As soon as he was out of sight, I forced myself to move, working the cable ties against the rough metal floor. It was slow, agonizing, but the ties finally snapped, and I slipped out of the van. I ran into the thick shrubs by the side, concealing myself just as Grant turned back. From my hiding place, I watched him walk back to Sam, his face twisted into something cold and inhuman. He began taunting him, but Sam was disoriented from whatever he had mixed in his water.
Come out now, beautiful, into my arms, or the snakes and spiders will get those thick legs of yours.
Then came the sounds, the dull thud of fists, the snap of bone. I pressed my hands to my mouth, tears streaming as I watched Grant torture Sam, trying to lure me out. But all I could do was crouch there in the dirt, praying. When it was over, Grant's voice sliced through the darkness.
Chloe, I know you're out there. Look, he's gone now. Let me be the man who takes care of you.
He prowled the scrub with a flashlight, sweeping it across the desert floor. Each time the light passed over me, I stopped breathing, my muscles clenched to stone. Grant took his time, enjoying the hunt, calling my name in a mocking tone that made my skin crawl. I sat there until morning, too afraid to move. My throat was raw from thirst, my mind barely holding on. Finally, I stumbled back to the road, hoping for a miracle. Hours later, a small truck appeared on the horizon, a dusty speck growing closer. I staggered into the road, waving my arms, and collapsed as the driver pulled over. I woke up in a hospital 2 days later, swarmed by police officers. They set out a hunt, and it took them 2 weeks to finally catch Grant. Unfortunately, Sam's body was never found, and Grant did not speak a word of it. This story draws inspiration from the real-life murder of Peter Falconio in 2001. Falconio and his girlfriend, Joanna Lees, were traveling through Australia's remote outback when they encountered Bradley John Murdoch, a local mechanic. Murdoch shot Falconio, then attempted to abduct Lees, who managed to escape and hide in the dense outback brush. She waited for hours, evading Murdoch and eventually flagged down a passing truck to safety. Falconio's body was never found, but Murdoch was later captured and convicted of his murder, serving a life sentence. This chilling case remains one of Australia's most infamous vacation tragedies. It was a quiet morning at the Ritz on Cancun. The hotel had its usual holiday energy. The pool was full of laughter as the music drifted up from below, and everything in that warm golden light you only get here. But something felt different that morning, a heaviness I couldn't shake. Room 427 was on my list that day. I'd been by it yesterday and noticed the Do Not Disturb sign left hanging for days. But people were on vacation. They'd get up to do their own things, and we respected their privacy. So I hadn't thought much of it until I stood there with the cleaning cart by my side, listening to the silence inside. I knocked twice. That careful housekeeping call and a bright voice meant to cut through even the heaviest hangover. Nothing. Just an unsettling quiet, thick like a fog around the door. It was on the third knock that I noticed. The was unlocked. I looked around, wondering if it was an accident. The DND sign was still there, but then I pushed the door open slowly. My heart skipped a beat as it creaked, and darkness met me from inside the room. The curtains were drawn tight, as if to keep the light out.
Ma'am? Sir? It's housekeeping.
I called loudly, waiting for a response as I slowly shuffled in. There were no voices, no hint of laughter or movement, only stillness that made my pulse quicken. As I stepped in, my eyes adjusted to the dimness. The bed was slightly unmade, a sheet crumpled halfway across. Shoes were left in a strange pattern on the carpet, like someone had stepped out quickly, never intending to come back. A faint smell hung in the air, not the usual leftover perfume or sunscreen. No, this was sharper, something bitter and metallic that seemed to settle heavy in my lungs. I felt a cold prickle at the back of my neck. Something was warning me that this wasn't right. But the smell, that coppery edge, the curiosity in me had to know. The smell grew stronger as I moved closer to the bathroom, each step making it harder to ignore. That metallic scent hit me again and again, stronger each time, almost sour. I whispered, calling out in a trembling voice.
Hola? ¿Hay alguien aquí?
But the only answer was silence, an echo that seemed to bounce right back at me. Then I saw it, a dark smudged streak trailing from the bed to the bathroom door, a line too dark to be anything but blood. My hands shook as I reached for the bathroom door, fingers barely gripping the handle. Every instinct screamed to me to leave, to close the door, to call someone else. But something stronger, a horrible kind of curiosity, pushed me to open it. The door opened slowly and I froze. Inside, the light from the bathroom cast a faint glow across the tiles. And there, lying twisted and still, was her body, slumped in the tub. The girl lay there in the bathtub with her head tipped to one side, eyes half open and glassy, staring into nothing. Her skin was pale as bruises darkened along her neck and arms, and there, on her wrists, were dark, angry marks, like she'd been held down, forced still, while someone took the life away from her. The water was pink, swirling in lazy circles in the tub like some grim, twisted snow globe holding a nightmare. I tried to breathe, but the air was thick, and the smell of iron filled my lungs until I thought I'd choke. I backed up, my foot slipping on the tile, my eyes glued to her face. She'd been beautiful once, long, dark hair, soft features, but now her lips were split, swollen. Her face held this look as if the last thing she'd seen wasn't of this world, but something from the depths, something so dark it had frozen her terror forever. I turned to leave, to run, but something kept me there, staring, as if I were in a trance. I wanted to scream, but my voice wouldn't come. And then, as I took one last look, I thought I saw her eyes, just for a second, flicker, like she was still there, trapped somehow, watching me, pleading. But it was just a trick of the light, a horror that burned into my mind that I'd never forget. I stumbled out of the room, feeling the walls press in around me. Every shadow held a shape, every sound stretched out like a whisper, something reminding me of the awful truth I'd just seen. When the police finally arrived, I watched them enter room 427, their eyes hard, their faces pale as they took in the scene. They didn't speak much, they didn't have to. Everything was in that room. Every dark detail was etched into the carpet, the walls, the tub. As they wheeled her out of room 427, the cat was out of the box. Sativa Transu was just 26. She had been here with her boyfriend, Taylor Allen. They'd come from Washington for what should have been a sunny escape in Cancun. But just hours before, she messaged friends, telling them she and Allen had argued. Her friends grew worried when she went silent after that. She'd never checked out, never answered. Allen had beaten her to death. It was a crime of passion. It was something cold and calculated. The boyfriend was arrested, and his blank, indifferent face was all over the screen, staring right at us like he didn't care what he'd done. When I closed my eyes that night, I saw her outline under that sheet. This story is based on the murder of Sativa. Sativa Transu, 26, and her boyfriend Taylor Allen, 31, were vacationing for the Thanksgiving holiday in Cancun, Mexico. A hotel worker found her inside her room on the 27th of November and called 911 to report an unconscious woman. According to the Mexican police, Transu was killed the previous night on 26 November. Allen was arrested for femicide by Mexican authorities. According to the Transu family, it is believed that Allen remains in prison in Mexico. It all started with a phone call in the middle of the night. Two British tourists were found dead on Sairi Beach, one of those paradise islands that travelers are so drawn to. The bodies, half naked and brutally beaten, showed signs of violence. The worst part, the girl Hannah Witheredge had been raped. I knew this case wouldn't be easy, but I never imagined it would be so complex. The morgue, it's not a pleasant place, but it's where everything begins. Salvador Leroux, the forensic examiner, was going over the bodies when I arrived. He told me they couldn't do fingerprint analysis. "We don't have the right technology," he murmured as he examined Hannah's body. Still, I couldn't shake the feeling that something didn't add up. Salvador, with his perpetually trembling hands, handed me a small crumpled piece of paper, an invitation to a party which had been found in the hands of David Miller, one of the victims who had drowned. Eric LaFleur was the name of the host, a seemingly ordinary tourist, but the coincidence that he had arrived on the same flight as the victims and rented the large hall for a party left me uneasy. I spoke to my colleague Ricardo. He's always been there for me in situations like this. I told him about Eric LaFleur. "You're right. He'll be a key figure. I'll try to check the city records just to see if I can find anything interesting," he suggested. Ricardo always had good ideas, and his help was never unwelcome. I went straight to the hotel where the couple were staying, but something strange happened. There was no record of Eric LaFleur at the hotel. It was as if he had never existed. When I reported this to my superiors, they immediately blocked me. They told me I couldn't investigate further without proper authorization. The hotel, its staff, everything gave me a bad feeling. I couldn't stand by and watch, so I decided to take matters into my own hands. I went to the scene of the crime, a deserted beach with salty, cold air. There wasn't much information left. The officers had already searched everything. To be honest, their lack of professionalism frightens me. This scene was compromised. But Ricardo sent me an interesting piece of information. Only one vehicle had been rented on the island in recent weeks, a lorry. The photos didn't reveal much, but it was enough to follow the trail. I decided to take Ricardo's advice again. "Why don't we check the security cameras?" I went to the local surveillance center and spoke to Eduardo, the manager. I knew I could trust him. We spent hours going through the footage until we saw the truck in question. It was on its way to a remote area of the island. Although the cameras only covered part of the route, it was something I could use. Armed with that information, I went there. There was blood on the floor, stains that had been hastily cleaned up. I knew I was onto something big, but I didn't realize how dangerous it was. I called Salvador, the forensic expert, and asked him to tell the officers to come and investigate. I insisted that he personally carry out a blood test. I think we've at least got that. That's the most basic thing. Several days have passed since my last report. I finally got the authorization I needed to investigate the hotel. I was eager to get to the bottom of things. The reception area was quite quiet. In fact, the receptionist offered to take me to the main hall herself, and they had prepared something very special for me as a gesture of goodwill. I expected it to be something of great importance, but judging by their words, they were probably just trying to get me drunk to get rid of me. Still, I wasn't going to be distracted. I told them that I wanted access to the rooms in the lower part, and they said that they would do it, but only after the gift. When I arrived at the hall, I didn't find any party or people. What I saw stopped me in my tracks. Bodies. Salvador, the forensic expert. Ricardo, my assistant, who had told me every detail of the case. And Eduardo, the man who helped me with the cameras. All dead. How? And why? I didn't have time to think about it. The police stormed the hall and immediately pointed to me as the main suspect. They accused me of killing the tourists and all the collaborators. It was ridiculous, but the case had already been built. The prosecutor presented evidence that seemed impossible to refute. My fingerprints on the car and on the bodies. But how? They told me it was impossible to lift fingerprints with the equipment they had. That's what I tried to explain. I told you all this in detail, straight from my diary, and here I am, standing before you, telling you every step I took, every clue I followed, every mistake I made, trying to convince you that I didn't do it. I told you how I discovered that there was someone else, someone powerful behind it all. Eric LaFleur wasn't just any tourist, as I said. He was connected to the highest circles of power. He even had meetings with a prominent congressman from the island, an untouchable man. It was obvious that I had been set up, but why? The new forensic expert, whom I had never seen before, delivered the final blow in the trial, claiming that he had always been in charge and that this so-called Salvador never existed. He said that the fingerprints on the van and the bodies were mine, as if it were irrefutable. But I knew it was impossible. I had never touched those bodies. Salvador, the original forensic expert, had died, and with him, the whole truth. And Eduardo, the only person who could have confirmed my version, was also dead. The most outrageous thing was that there were two other men, obviously beaten and tortured, who claimed to be my accomplices. I'd never seen these men before, but they produced photos with them that was clearly doctored. There was nothing I could do. I was sentenced to life imprisonment. Everything was too perfectly orchestrated, every piece carefully placed to incriminate me. I left the courtroom in silence, and as I passed through the doors, I saw him, Eric LaFleur, sitting in a nearby restaurant, enjoying his meal as if nothing had happened. He looked at me, and his smile froze my soul. He was the hidden killer, and now, while I was on my way to prison, he was free and laughing. In September 2014, the bodies of two British tourists, Hannah Witheridge and David Miller, were found on Sairi Beach, Koh Tao, Thailand. Both had been brutally murdered. Hannah was raped and beaten, while David was beaten and drowned. Thai police, under pressure over the potential impact on tourism, launched an investigation and quickly arrested two Burmese migrant workers, Zaw Lin and Wai Pho, on the basis of DNA evidence and confessions obtained after lengthy interrogation. However, the defendants claimed that their confessions had been extracted under torture. The case drew international criticism for the mishandling of evidence, possible contamination of the crime scene, and lack of due process. Despite the irregularities in the investigation, the two Burmese men were sentenced to death in 2015. In 2020, their sentences were commuted to life imprisonment by the King of Thailand.